This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Northern California is burning, Puerto Rico is still grieving, and some rideshare companies are sweating. Just a few stories from a week of big headlines, more than enough to get us through the Friday News Roundup. Joining us this week to help us make sense of the top stories is Alexandra Jaffe, a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Alexandra, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Ball is a national political correspondent for Time. Molly, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey, Joshua. Thank you.
Let's begin with politics. Some history was made during the primaries on Tuesday. More women than ever before are nominated for House seats. Those nominees include Rashida Tlaib, who will likely, by some accounts, become the first Muslim woman to serve in Congress. She spoke to WDET Public Radio in Detroit for its program Detroit Today.
I really want to change lives. I ran for office because I believe that we're so much better. I'm so optimistic, even more today than ever, that our country can be better, that we can be Democrats that don't waver against big banks, that we won't waver against big corporate bullies, especially polluters. These are things that I believe is changing. You know, people talk about the blue wave. I say, forget that. Let's own the ocean. We don't need to, you know, waves come and go, Stephen. We need to really change the landscape of how we're represented in Congress.
That's Rashida Tlaib talking to Stephen Henderson on Detroit Today from WDET Public Radio. Molly Ball, let me start with you and this win by Rashida Tlaib, winning the nomination to take over the seat that John Conyers held for quite some time. How expected or unexpected was her win?
I believe she's actually guaranteed a seat in Congress because I think she's running unopposed in the general election. So she will be the first Muslim woman in Congress. But this is a phenomenon we are seeing all over the country in Democratic primaries specifically, that the women are winning. The trend in Democratic primaries all year long, we've heard a lot about, you know, the ideological split between the Hillary wing and the Bernie wing of the party. But the actual trend, it's not that the centrists are winning or the liberals are winning. It's the women are winning almost every time. Women are in Democratic primaries where there's been a man and a woman on the ballot. The women have won the most votes 71% of the time. It is not the case in Republican primaries. Men are women winning against women more often in Republican primaries. But this is also, you know, we've seen since Donald Trump was elected, this wave of activism by women, the Women's March. If there is a blue wave, the wave will be made of women.
And Tuesday night, it marked an important milestone when it comes to women because it's the most women ever nominated to run in races in a general election across the country.
I was going to ask Alexandra about, I understand that the kind of Hillary versus Bernie dichotomy has maybe it's a little played out. We've talked about it so much, but I do wonder where she falls in terms of the kind of Democratic spectrum. Does she feel more like an establishment Democrat? Does she feel more like a Democrat who wants to pull the party further left? Like, where does she sit?
She was sort of an honest progressive, but not as progressive as many of the other candidates in the race. So she's more of a moderate progressive in that district. But in other districts in Michigan, we saw sort of moderates, establishment candidates win. Like in the gubernatorial primary, Gretchen Whitmer was another woman that won over a progressive candidate that was backed by Bernie Sanders. That was Abdul El-Sayed. He ran as a Bernie Sanders candidate. He was pro sort of Medicare for all. He wanted to make Michigan a sanctuary city. And though he surged in the final weeks, Bernie Sanders actually came to campaign for him. He wasn't able to pull it out. So this was actually a bad night for progressives. We saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, the candidate that took down Joe Crowley and became sort of a rallying cry for progressives, go out there, campaign for a number of candidates, not just in Michigan, but in places like Missouri. All of our candidates lost. So this was a good night for sort of moderate and more establishment-minded Democrats.
Let's talk about Ohio for a minute. Not all of Tuesday's races ended quite so neatly as the one we just described. Many people still have their eyes on Ohio's 12th district. It's to take the seat of Congressman Pat Tabiri. Republican Troy Balderson and Democrat Danny O'Connor are kind of neck and neck right now. And Domenico, this feels like one of these races that people are treating as a bellwether for November. What should we be taking away from where this race stands right now?
Well, a couple things on just where the results are. O'Connor wound up making up some more votes from a suburban area last night where some more votes came in. He's about 1,500 votes or so behind Troy Balderson, the Republican. There are about 8,500 provisional ballots and absentee ballots combined remaining. That would mean that O'Connor would need something like 55% of the remaining ballots to wind up within the 0.5% threshold for an automatic recount in the state. He would need about 60-61% to take the lead. So that's still a high bar. You'll probably see the margin close somewhat. As to why people cared about this so much, a part of it is because this is a district that only once since 1940 have Democrats held. This is a seat that's been held by Republicans for 30 years. This was John Kasich's district. And John Kasich, when he represented this district, he talked out about this on Sunday and said that this is a race that should be a slam dunk, and it's not. This is a place that Republicans should win fairly easily. President Trump won this district by 11 points. And when I was crunching the numbers on this the day before the race, there are 69 seats that President Trump either won by less than this in 2016 or that Hillary Clinton won. So that shows you just how wide the landscape is. This isn't just a suburban district that's like other places. There are a lot more liberal districts than this that are far more competitive. And remember, Democrats only need to net 23 seats to take back the House.
Molly, we should also talk about Kansas and its gubernatorial primary. The current governor, Jeff Collier, is in a tight race with Kris Kobach, who is the somewhat controversial Secretary of State. Part of the issue has to do with the fact that the Secretary of State oversees elections and the matter of vote counting is a thing this time around.
Well, it's always been a thing for Kris Kobach specifically because he has been very vocal on the issue of voter fraud and was the head of Donald Trump's task force on voter fraud that disbanded amid quite a bit of controversy.
I'm sorry, this is the task force whereby the president claimed he would have won outright in the popular vote if there had not been a few million kind of questionable votes cast.
It claimed completely without evidence, and no one has ever come up with any evidence to that effect. And when there has been evidence of vote fraud, the instances have been very, very few and far between nationally and historically. That being said, Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State, did recuse himself from the vote counting last night amid accusations from his opponent, the incumbent Republican governor of the state, that he was not supervising, that he had a conflict of interest in supervising the vote count in his own race, a race that is very, very close within just a couple of hundred votes, I believe.
Yeah, it's only 91 now.
91 less than 100 votes now.
The
margin has shifted.
Three.
This is a very interesting race for many reasons. Kansas, the governorship in Kansas, the politics of Kansas have been interesting for years. But one of the biggest reasons it's interesting is because of the involvement of the president. Donald Trump has been advised by Kobach. Kobach was a big supporter of Trump. Kobach is known nationally not just for voter fraud, but for his work on immigration issues across the country. And he's viewed as a polarizing far-right figure. And most Republican political strategists in and outside Kansas believe that he would have a harder time winning the general election than the incumbent Republican governor. And Donald Trump's advisors were hoping that he would stay out of it. But Trump issued a surprise last-minute endorsement on Twitter that tends to be helpful in Republican primaries and may be part of the reason that this race is so close.
Let's back up to that Ohio 12th race for just a second. Freeman tweeted, "I live in Ohio 12. This is not a bellwether. This is a district in Columbus that is turning blue and has for decades."
Well, okay. That may be the case that it's becoming bluer. The Democrat in the race, Danny O'Connor, is from Franklin County, which is the most sort of progressive county within that district. But there are still a bunch of rural districts that make it more difficult. I think when people talk about it being a bellwether, this is a more conservative district than the other places in the country that had been seen as conservative, or I'm sorry, that had been seen as competitive for Democrats or Republicans to have to run in where the sort of landscape was being set. So the point is that if this is a district that President Trump won by more than those places, this really widens the battlefield potentially.
And you have to look at what it took for Republicans to win that district. There was one outside group that spent, I think, more than $3.2 million to shore up Balderson. And they can't spend that much money in every race that's going to be contested. That's going to be a problem going forward into the midterms for Republicans.
The official death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria devastated the island was 64 people. But in a report to Congress this week, the Puerto Rican government rose that figure from 64 to more than 1,400 people who died in the months after the storm. This higher estimate aligns with what several independent academic accounts have found, including one from Harvard and another from the Journal of the American Medical Association. Accuracy in documenting hurricane-related deaths matters to the recovery resources and federal aid that Puerto Rico gets offered. The Commonwealth is still struggling with power outages and safe drinking water nearly a year after that hurricane hit. It's just one of many stories that caught our attention this week. Let's talk about the Russia probe for just a minute and the continuing back and forth over whether or not President Trump will sit down with a special counsel and be interviewed or interrogated, whatever your perspective might be. Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani told Sean Hannity on Wednesday that his legal team has rejected Mr. Mueller's ground rules for a proposed meeting. He also said that this matter will be resolved by the 1st of September, in his words, one way or another. Now, Molly, according to a number of reports and according to what the president said, he wants to meet with Robert Mueller. Rudy Giuliani seemed concerned in what he said about Robert Mueller being able to kind of trick the president into perjuring himself. What's going on?
Well, there's a few things going on here. It's somewhat remarkable that they are still having this negotiation, given that most lawyers in general, and certainly most of the president's legal team, do not believe he should consent to any kind of interview with Robert Mueller. But because Trump has left this door open and appears indeed confident about such a prospect, the negotiation has continued. And as long as that door is a little bit open, the Mueller team is going to continue to try to find a way to do it. Rudy Giuliani is engaged in a public relations strategy here, and he has admitted as much. He is largely concerned with swaying public opinion and helping Trump make the case to his supporters that this is a rigged witch hunt. So a lot of his comments have more to do with that than with any legal strategy. And so and he has repeatedly set supposed deadlines that have not been met. And this is, I think, a way of bolstering their claim that this investigation has dragged on too long. But in this week, they responded to the Mueller team's offer of an interview with certain conditions on it. But they appear to have set conditions that would be a deal breaker for such an interview by ruling out any questions about the things that the prosecutors would want to have an interview to discuss. So part of what they may also be doing here is trying to sort of run out the clock because the minute they say no to an interview instead of saying maybe, that sets up the prospect of a subpoena. And that would become a huge legal battle and could force the president to testify.
Yeah, and Molly, depending on who you talk to, I've heard some legal scholars say that if the special counsel tried to subpoena the president to testify, they might win. They might be able to make him.
Well, part of the issue here, though, is that, you know, you've got Brett Kavanaugh sort of sitting out there with the Supreme Court. And, you know, Mitch McConnell wants to really push through his nomination and get him confirmed before the November elections. And the reason that's really important as it relates to the Mueller investigation is because Kavanaugh is known to have a really expansive view of presidential power. A lot of scholars aren't sure whether or not he would, in fact, say that he would be against, for example, a subpoena from the Mueller team to say that this is it, you know, it would hurt the presidency and would stop the president from being able to do his job. Now, that's part of this run out the ball, run out the clock strategy, because, you know, this will go through the legal system. That's why Mueller doesn't want to have to go that route and is much more amenable to wanting to negotiate. You take questions of the conduct of Mike Flynn and James Comey and obstruction, and you have no interview. So that's not something he wants to do.
Right. Yeah. Alexandra, speaking of the Mueller investigation, we should talk about the first trial to come out of that probe that had some fairly high drama this week. It was the trial of Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign manager, the then candidate's former campaign manager. He's on trial in federal court. Prosecutors accuse him of not paying tens of millions of dollars, paying taxes on millions of dollars that he earned while lobbying in Ukraine and then lying to get loans when the cash ran out. Now, the prosecution star witness, Alexandra, has been Rick Gates, Manafort's one-time business associate, his deputy. He testified for 3 days this week. It looks like, at least from the prosecution's pace and from the way they've constructed their case, that they are very confident that they can just kind of go in and throw a knockout punch in the first round and then be home in time for supper. Is that right. The way this is playing out?
They're expected to rest their case today after sort of a week of explosive testimony, not just from Rick Gates, but from a number of financial experts and financial workers that worked with Paul Manafort and have documentation that showed that he signed his name to falsified loan documents. He specifically asked for transfers from overseas accounts that he called his own. So regardless of whether Rick Gates' testimony is believable or not, there is hard evidence, there's paper evidence that Manafort did something wrong. That said, Gates' testimony was pretty explosive. He admitted outright that both of them committed crimes, financial crimes. He said that he was involved with Manafort in trying to set up some of these overseas accounts to avoid tax collection. So that was sort of a revelation as to how this relationship worked, as to how Manafort received a lot of his money from sort of Ukrainian oligarchs. It gave us more information about that controversy that we've been hearing about for months.
Well, and Alexandra, it seemed like the defense, from the way that they made their opening statement, the bulk of their defense wrapped around discrediting Rick Gates, that he's right. not a credible witness, that because he's a fellow criminal, why are you taking his word for right. it? I wonder, I don't want us to try to get into the heads of the jurors, but I wonder if we have any sense of where the defense might have to go to make that work. It sounds like the evidence was much more than just Rick Gates. They had someone from the IRS right, testify. Exactly. Like it was bigger than that. Molly?
Well, you have to remember that the defense has not yet presented its case. So part right. of the reason that the evidence seems one-sided is that only one side has presented. So after the prosecution rests its case, then the defense will have its chance. And so thus far, what they have done is try to impeach the testimony of Rick Gates and paint him as unreliable. He's an admitted liar. He's an admitted criminal. How can you believe anything that he says? But they will have the opportunity to present other countervailing evidence if they have it after the prosecution finishes.
Lori in Cincinnati asked, please ask your guests to comment on the judge in the Manafort case. I'm so worried that he is placing a heavy thumb on the scale of justice by acting as if this is not a serious case, hurrying up the prosecution to a ridiculous pace. So disheartening to see the courts so partisan. Domenico, what about the judge?
Well, he's definitely a character. I mean, T.S. Ellis is the man's name, and he is a former Bush appointee, as I believe. But, you know, this court as the rocket docket. So it's not that he's hurrying them along. It just so happens that this is a place where they move quickly. And, you know, there's something to be said for being able to summarize your best points and make the best case you can in a week. You know, as journalists and reporters, it's sort of like if you had a week to tell a story, you know, you better tell it.
Right. You get cracking.
So, you know, there are some people, though, who complain about Ellis's tactics in the courtroom. I heard one person say on one of the cable shows last night that, you know, he wishes, this is a former prosecutor, said that he wished that Ellis would just call more balls and strikes rather than try to play all nine positions on the field. And he's a very active judge. And I think the concern in the courtroom is that anything that he might say that might, you know, be maybe too harsh on one side or the other could affect a jury. Now, remember, this is still a jury trial. So as much evidence as there is against Paul Manafort, I mean, he did have offshore undeclared bank accounts, right? I mean, that's a crime. He can talk about how that's, you know, a mistake. He didn't pay taxes on some $60 million. People are, you know, coming to talk about the fact that he didn't do that. And there's obviously evidence that he didn't do that. But all it takes is one juror, and that juror could be or could not be influenced by the judge.
I do want to talk immigration in just a moment, but first, it was another story regarding one of the president's tweets that made news this week. The host of CNN Tonight, Don Lemon, took 9 minutes out of his show on Monday to address a tweet from the president. He decided on Friday, the president decided, to attack Lemon's intelligence and that of LeBron James, who's been making the headlines after opening this new school. Here is part of what Don Lemon said in response to the president's tweet.
Well, unlike this president who lashes out wildly at anyone who criticizes him, I have pretty thick skin. And LeBron James, in addition to being a brilliant black man, a superstar in his sport and a hero to his community, is taking the high road, which is exactly where he belongs. So since this president, since he spews so many insults so often, the president has called a lot of people stupid. Some of those people are white. But I would just like to note that referring to African Americans as dumb, remember this is America, referring to African Americans as dumb is one of the oldest canards of America's racist past and present, that black people are of inferior intelligence.
Part of what Don Lemon said on CNN Tonight this Monday. By the way, the tweet from the president read, quote, LeBron James was just interviewed by the dumbest man on television, Don Lemon. He made LeBron look smart, which isn't easy to do. I like Mike, unquote. Now, after he described this incident, Lemon went on to list a rundown of the president's repeated attacks, specifically on the intelligence of black public figures who are critics of him and his administration. First Lady Melania Trump released a statement after this feud praising LeBron for his charity work. I'm kind of not sure what to make of this, Alexandra. I mean, on the one hand, Don Lemon is right that insulting the intelligence of black people as part of our supposedly inherent inferiority is as old as the triangular trade.
Right.
However, Don Lemon's a public figure. You kind of have to put up with that kind of thing as a public figure. We know the president doesn't like members of the media. Who cares? I'm not sure what to think of this.
But this is a particular pattern with President Trump. I mean, most recently we saw him go after Maxine Waters and say that she had a low IQ at a rally that he had.
And she went right back after him.
Exactly.
She is not the one to come for.
He's happy to have that fight. But I think we are seeing some of his targets pick up that fight and respond to what are obviously racially tinged remarks from the president. So I don't think you can blame Don Lemon for defending himself. But like he said, he's uncomfortable because becoming part of the story. The problem is Donald Trump has made it the story. So this didn't have to be a controversy to begin with, but Donald Trump chose to put out that tweet.
Molly?
I just wanted to point out that he did the same thing again just this morning, tweeting about the NFL players who continue to protest injustice from the sidelines or the locker room and saying that they had no idea what they were even protesting about. So exactly the same pattern that Don Lemon was talking about. I mean, I think the who cares question is a valid one, but it ought to be directed at the president. What is he doing spending his Friday nights watching CNN and picking on athletes and television hosts? Is that really the best use of his time?
And before Domenico chimes in, the tweets that the president sent this morning read, quote, the NFL players are at it again, taking a knee when they should be standing proudly for the national anthem. Numerous players from different teams wanted to show their quote-unquote outrage at something that most of them are unable to define. They make a fortune doing what they love. Be happy. Be cool. A football game that fans are paying so much money to watch and enjoy is no place to protest. Most of that money goes to the players anyway. Find another way to protest. Stand proudly for your national anthem or be suspended without pay, unquote.
You know, we live in the moment with a lot of these things, and there's a long history in sports of black athletes standing up against what they see as political injustice and having the powers that be say they shouldn't. Go all the way back to John Carlos and Tommy Smith standing on the podium in the 1968 Olympic Games with their fists in the air and essentially run out of the sport. The white Australian who stood with them was essentially banned from the sport until he was posthumously allowed back in. Look at someone like Kurt Flood, who, if not for him, there wouldn't be the kind of free agency that there is in Major League Baseball. And he was essentially run out of the country and not allowed back in the sport until he was recognized years later in the 90s. And he suffered from depression and abandoned his family and moved to Spain. You know, there is a long history of this where people who want the status quo to remain as it is put a lot of pressure on these black athletes who decide that they want to speak out against political injustice.
Not the least of which being Colin Kaepernick.
Absolutely.
Who still hasn't found a place back in the NFL.
I mean, that's where we bring us to modern day, right? I mean, you know, the Kaepernick stuff, the kneeling in the NFL, which essentially of players standing in solidarity with Kaepernick, and a lot of owners too, by the way, because they know who's playing on their teams. If you had a strike of every black athlete in professional sports say that they weren't going to play for white owners anymore, what would that do to the sports?
James emailed, Trump could care less about LeBron or Lemon. It's a don't look at Manafort ploy. We should talk immigration for a moment. For the second straight month, the number of migrants trying to enter the U.S. is down. Arrests at the southwest border are down, too. There were more than 42,000 arrests in June. Last month in July, that number dropped to just under 40,000. Alexandra, how should we read this? As I recall, undocumented border crossings have been dropping for quite some time, right?
Exactly. And that's why experts are raising questions about the Trump administration's claim that this is evidence that the zero tolerance policy is working, that it's actually dissuading immigrants from even trying to cross the border. This has been an ongoing trend, and these numbers actually track pretty closely with what we saw during the summer of 2015. Some experts suggest it's just because of hot temperatures. It's not the right time for people to be crossing the border to begin with. So whether this is a cause of Trump, you know, policies is an open question. But regardless, this is something that Trump's going to use as evidence that his policies are working. The question is whether he can keep claiming that immigration, illegal immigration, is a problem while also claiming his policies are a win. There's a little bit of a contradiction in terms there. So as he goes into the 2018 elections, can he keep touting these decline in numbers but keep telling voters, yes, but we still need the wall. Yes, but we still need stepped up enforcement.
Well, and Molly, there's also the matter of just the immigration crackdowns most recently with children being separated from their parents. I mean, quite a bit of the policies are still tied up in legal knots as to whether or not the president can even do these things. And if he can, how?
That's right. The attempt to roll back DACA remains in court. DACA remains in place. The Obama executive action that allowed many young people brought to the United States illegally as children to remain in the country and to work. There's a lot of litigation, as you mentioned, over the child separation policy. The government has been ordered to reunite these families. And the changes to asylum policy that were made by the Attorney General also are in court, and just yesterday, a judge threatened to hold the Attorney General in contempt for having preemptively deported a family, a mother and her child, whose asylum case was still proceeding through the courts.
I want to pick up with that story and also with an update on California's wildfires in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows, all with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Tamara.
We are the NPR Politics Podcast.
This week, Paul Manafort is on trial.
He, of course, is President Trump's former campaign chairman.
So when there's news from that trial, the NPR Politics Pod Squad will run out of the courtroom and bring you what you need to know.
We mentioned this federal judge who blocked the Trump administration from deporting some asylum seekers. That order came as two asylum seekers were already on a plane back to El Salvador. So their case was in court, and the government had already begun flying them out of the country. D.C. District Judge Emmett Sullivan was visibly ticked by discovering this. He ordered the plane to turn around immediately, even if it had to turn around in flight. Transcripts show that he said, among other things, in court, quote, "Oh, I want those people brought back forthwith. I'm not asking, I'm ordering," unquote. Judge Sullivan also threatened to hold Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, and other officials in contempt of court, calling the deportations unacceptable. The government complied with the court's order and returned the pair to Texas after the plane had landed. Their immigration cases are still pending. Another immigration story to watch involves immigrants with legal resident status in the U.S. And again, I'm saying legal. The Trump administration reportedly is moving forward with a plan to revoke that legal status for immigrants who've accessed government benefits like food stamps, Medicaid, public housing, or even the Affordable Care Act. Domenico, what's behind this proposal to target, or this plan to target legal residents in this way?
Well, we know that this White House has said that it wants to curtail legal immigration and that they want merit-based legal immigration. So, you know, that kind of goes against what the U.S. was sort of created on. I mean, a lot of people who've come to this country, you know, most of them who come here are because they're seeking economic opportunity or they're escaping some violence in their country.
It's that whole thing about tired, poor, huddled masses.
Well, I mean, right. And you saw Stephen Miller, the president's advisor on immigration, combat that idea at the White House in a very, you know, kind of provocative way in a back and forth with the media last year in talking about that plaque and how it was, you know, he said added later. But it is a fundamental thing that a lot of people believe. I mean, just personally, my father came here in 1961 from Italy, and it's not because they came here with, you know, a long resume to try to help the United States set up tech firms or something. You know, they were escaping poverty in post-World War II Italy. So that's what it was like for a lot of people who've come here, especially in the 20th century post-industrial revolution.
One more immigration story we should mention before we move on, a story that's quite close to home for the president. Mr. Trump's mother and father-in-law became citizens this week at a private ceremony in Manhattan. Melania Trump sponsored green cards for her parents, who are Slovenian, as part of the family-based immigration program. About 7 million people have taken advantage of this program since the year 2007. Under different circumstances, President Trump and his supporters might call this something that he has repeatedly called for the end of. It is, depending on who you ask, the very textbook definition of chain migration. Let's talk about the wildfires in California, specifically the Mendocino Complex fire up in Northern California. It is now the largest wildfire in California's state history. It may take until next month to contain these blazes. Firefighters from as far away as Australia and New Zealand are helping fight the spread of these fires. Joining us now to discuss it is Suki Lewis, a reporter with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. She's been covering these wildfires. So where do these fires stand? I mean, the Mendocino Complex fire, it's kind of two fires. It's grown gigantic in scope. It's larger in area than the city of Los Angeles. Do firefighters feel like they're getting the upper hand on these fires, or are they still just fighting to begin establishing steady containment?
So they're definitely getting a handle on these fires, you know, compared to where we were at, you know, just a few days ago. I feel like they're steadily building containment. You mentioned there were two fires. This is the River Fire and the Ranch Fire. The River Fire is now at 87% containment. They feel really good about that one. The Ranch Fire is at 50% containment, and that's the one that is, like, just ridiculously massive. It's huge, you know, more than 250,000 acres alone. And the area that it's burning in now is super rural. It's, like, way out in these mountains. It's quite hard to go direct on it, which is basically to fight the fire head on. So what they're doing is kind of building these containment lines kind of out from the fire where they can get to, where, you know, dirt roads, rural roads can take them in order to kind of build this line that the fire then can't get past to threaten more land and more structures and more people.
Talk about what you've seen on the ground in the Mendocino Complex fire. Can you describe to us some of the scene?
Yeah, so I went up actually and embedded with a CAL FIRE team as they were doing some of this work that I was just talking about, this containment work. And, you know, as you're driving through, like, you know, first we kind of drove past some of the body of where the main destruction had happened. And you just see these, like, hillsides that are, like, white with ash, with kind of the black trees, you know, remains of trees kind of poking up through the ash. And then we got into the kind of more active fire area where you see these spot fires still kind of smoking in, you know, in the underbrush. And a lot of, you know, the work they were doing, you know, the day that I was up there was called kind of mop-up work, where they're going back. There was an area where the ranch fire had spilled over one of the containment lines. So the winds tend to pick up in the afternoon and start blowing fire around. And so they were going back through trying to resecure that and, you know, do their best to, you know, and a lot of what they do actually is lighting fires. So lighting these controlled burns to burn back toward the main body of the fire and protect like the ranch lands that are beyond this.
You spoke to CAL FIRE Captain Stevie Long. Here's part of what he had to say about the changing nature of this firefight.
I think the biggest challenge, you know, obviously now is that our drought, so our fires are burning a lot quicker, a lot hotter, a lot faster. So I would say that's the current challenge for me, is that fire still is burning at night.
Suki, I wonder if what she described has to do with the international presence of this firefight. Firefighters coming from New Zealand and Australia, which is not unprecedented in fighting fires, but I'm hearing a lot more about it, that California needs more international help to kind of get a handle on this.
Yeah, I mean, these fires have been like a massive mutual aid effort. And, you know, mutual aid is the system that was actually kind of started in California, where neighbors tap neighbors. And they say, like, we need this many, you know, people at this fire, we need this many people at this fire. And I think the demand for firefighters here has just been even beyond the scope of what California can handle on its own. Now, from Australia and New Zealand, there wasn't a huge number of firefighters. I think there's about 50 from what CAL FIRE leaders told me. But as we know, like, Australia has a lot of experience dealing with wildfires and also experience dealing with drought. And so I think this mutual aid, you know, it for one thing, it does help, like all the numbers help. And I think also it's this feeling of like sharing knowledge and, you know, growing together as a world to deal with the challenges of climate change and so on.
Yeah, I did want to ask you, Suki, also about some of how these fires are affecting folks nearby. I mean, smoke and flames from another fire, the Ferguson Fire, have closed some of Yosemite National Park to visitors. I don't think you can get in most of the Yosemite Valley right now. There's also another fire in Southern California that a man has been charged with arson for allegedly intentionally supposedly setting a fire in a residential area that's prompted 20,000 evacuations. How are Californians dealing with all these fires?
I think there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fatigue. I mean, last year, we're coming out of September of last year, where, you know, so many thousands of homes were burned in Sonoma, Napa, Mendocino counties. And there's just this feeling of like, where is it going to strike next? Is it going to be me? And for those who are kind of dealing with evacuation fatigue, where it's like, okay, I'm evacuating again, you know, in Lake County, where I was up reporting on the ranch fire, they've had the last 4 years kind of major evacuations and major fires every single summer, if not once, you know, twice, three times. And so people are just like, really? Like, this is life now? You know, people are, one woman I talked to said her neighbor basically at the beginning of the summer packs up their whole house, takes all the photos off the walls, you know, puts everything into a trailer so that at any moment she can hook the trailer up and get out. But that's kind of a crazy way to live.
Suki Lewis from KQED Public Radio. Suki, stay on the line with us if you would. I want to move on to a few more stories before our time is up. Let's talk a little bit now about a story that quite a lot of you have been commenting on, a story that could take the United States military to a galaxy far, far away. This week, we learned more about plans to develop another branch of the military, which at the moment would be referred to as the United States Space Force. Vice President Mike Pence laid out some details of this plan in a speech yesterday at the Pentagon.
Just as in the past, when we created the Air Force, establishing the Space Force is an idea whose time has come. The space environment has fundamentally changed in the last generation. What was once peaceful and uncontested is now crowded and adversarial. Today, other nations are seeking to disrupt our space-based systems and challenge American supremacy in space as never before.
Not surprisingly, this was real fodder for the late-night comedians. Jimmy Kimmel even went so far as to create a parody recruitment ad for the Space Force.
We're the strong.
The brave.
The sixth best.
We are the Space Force.
The Space Force.
The United States Space Force.
We're not a
entirely sure what we'd do.
But whatever it is, it sounds totally badass.
I hope I get a lightsaber. That would be lit!
Part of the recruitment ad from Jimmy Kimmel on ABC. Lots of comments from you about the Space Force. Paul tweeted, "The Space Force accomplishes two goals. It establishes an enormous slush fund for aerospace and military contractors, and it shows unequivocally that our Congress will go to literally any length to avoid funding infrastructure and healthcare." Damon wrote on our Facebook page, "Why is it that they find money for a military Space Force, but they can't find money for infrastructure?" And Mars tweeted, "We don't need a space force. We need a cyber force instead. That makes more sense." Now, Molly, Secretary of Defense James Mattis says he now supports the Space Force. He didn't sign on to this idea at first. There are efforts, it is worth noting, to try to create weapons that affect our grid, and some of them could come through satellites. I mean, if the GPS system got disrupted, that would be a catastrophe. However, a space force, is this a real idea?
Well, it is now, but I think to the point that some of the some of your correspondents made, Congress has not consented to this, and Congress would be required to pass legislation in order to create another branch of the military. So where it stands now is the president having sort of thrown this out there. Policymakers have put serious meat on the bones, the Pentagon drawing up real plans for this to be another branch, and the vice president making a serious case for it. Look, there is a serious case to be made for the United States having this type of a military structure. There is also a serious case to be made against it. Unfortunately, it's turned into more of a joke, and the president is partly to blame for that, too. His campaign sent out a fundraising email with a bunch of logos for the Space Force. So, and it's something that his supporters have fastened upon at rallies. It has become a chant, in fact. So I think that this idea has sort of entered the popular imagination much more than it has entered reality, because there's very little appetite in Congress to actually do this and to fund it.
I know we're low on time, but one more story that a number of you wanted to hear about involves the VA, and an investigation by ProPublica called The Shadow Rulers of the VA revealed that some wealthy members of the Trump-owned Mar-a-Lago on Palm Beach seem to have a strong hand in shaping policy at the VA department. Alexandra, what's this about? Can you kind of give us the headline before we got to go?
Right. Mar-a-Lago described them as the, ProPublica described them as the Mar-a-Lago crowd. It was three sort of businessmen that have access to Trump, are members of Mar-a-Lago, and somehow have outsized influence over the VA policy and activities, despite the fact they're not veterans and they have no experience in government. So after this investigation, Democrats have called for a broader investigation into whether this is cronyism and pay-for-play activity, because they're paying for Mar-a-Lago memberships and getting access to government officials.
Has the White House responded to this, Domenico, before we go?
They have not responded within that story. They have responded in the past that these three do not have, you know, power or control over any of the decisions that actually get made.
NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you.
And Alexandra Jaffe, a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Alexandra, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone, because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
The United States reimposed sanctions on Iran this week after pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal this year. Russia was another sanctions target. Things have gotten nasty between Canada and Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen, which many thought could not get worse, has. Venezuela's president survives a bizarre and bungled assassination attempt, and Britain's ban on burqas trips up a flamboyant blonde who believes he's a shoo-in to be the next prime minister. Plenty to discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us to help make sense of it all are Jennifer Williams, James Kitfield, and Simon Marks. Jennifer is the foreign editor for Vox and co-host of the podcast Worldly. Jennifer, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
James is senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the author of Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. James, welcome.
Good to be back.
And Simon is president and chief correspondent for Feature Story News, a news service specializing in international affairs. Hey, Simon.
Great seeing you, Joshua.
Great to see your questions and thoughts as well on the top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A at WAMU.org, or tweet us at 1A. Speaking of tweets, let's start with one. This one is from Dmitry Polyansky. He's the first deputy permanent representative of Russia to the United Nations. Mr. Polyansky tweeted, quote, "The theater of the absurd continues. No proofs, no clues, no logic, no presumption of innocence, just highly likelies. Only one rule, blame everything on Russia. Let us welcome the United Sanctions of America." Unquote. Russia was not the only country hit by new sanctions this week. We'll get to Iran in just a minute, but the State Department says the new measures on Russia will come into effect on August 22nd. And it threatened more punitive action, including suspending diplomatic relations and revoking Aeroflot's landing rights if Russia does not take what it calls remedial action within 90 days. Jennifer Williams, what's this all about? What is it that Russia has to remediate?
So, basically, this is all going back to the attempted assassination of the former UK spy, Sergei Skripal, in the UK in March. And, you know, the tweet that that you just read, talking about sanctions and the highly likely. So, you know, the UK government and spy agencies and technical experts basically went through and looked at the evidence and did all the kind of, you know, technical tests you need to do and came to the conclusion that it's highly likely that Russia did it because they used Novichok, and that was basically only made in the Soviet Union. So it's kind of, you know, you narrow it down, it's probably Russia. There's not a whole lot of other options. And, you know, Vladimir Putin also has a kind of history of assassinating or attempting to assassinate rivals, people he doesn't like, former spies, things like that. So there's really no question that it's Russia. And the problem is that Russia, being the masters of disinformation that they are, have put out this kind of question mark. How come you can't prove it? We haven't seen the evidence. Why don't you, you know, let Russians come and help you investigate? And they're just kind of pumping this out over and over again to the point that, you know, regular people are understandably confused. Like, well, what is the proof? Because I haven't seen it, right? Have you? But, you know, basically, I'm not going to get to see a Novichok sample.
I wonder if we can consider whether America is sending maybe some mixed messages here, Simon. I mean, here is House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce, Republican, speaking last weekend to Jake Tapper on CNN.
We are in a position now where we have got to show Putin that he'll have to pay a steep price. I'm the author of the bill that put the sweeping sanctions on Russia. We need to use that more effectively now, and we need, frankly, to be more aggressive in using other tools we have, where we could go after Russia for their use of nerve agents in the UK. Across the board, we need to be pressing right now.
That's House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce speaking on CNN last weekend. Kind of opens the question, Simon, in terms of who's running the table on Russia policy, whether it's the State Department and more hawkish elements in the House, like Chairman Royce, or the White House, which is trying to have more of an open posture toward Vladimir Putin.
Absolutely. Look, this is the tale of two American foreign policies, and I suspect other subjects that we discuss during this hour will also yield that same tale. But it was notable that it fell to the State Department and to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to make this announcement this week. The White House has said absolutely nothing publicly whatsoever about these Russian sanctions, and we certainly haven't heard anything from President Donald Trump, even though he's been volubly tweeting away at his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey, on a variety of topics all week. The State Department's hands in this were tied by law. There is a law called the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act. It's a mouthful, but it requires the American government, within 60 days of a suspected chemical attack, to make a decision as to whether it was indeed a chemical or biological weapons attack. Now, the Trump administration blew past the 60-day deadline. Mike Pompeo makes the determination formally that it was the Russian government, and it's important that the U.S. said the Russian government, not elements within Russia, but the government that was responsible for all of that. And that then results in the sanctions that are going to kick in on August the 22nd, most of which are going to be targeted on goods that have a potential national security use. But it then also requires the Russian government to respond to that finding within the next 90 days or face much tougher sanctions that could include the grounding of Aeroflot flights that come into the United States on a daily basis. That's a big deal. The White House may not like what the State Department has done this week, but ultimately, the law is the law. And that's where this gets interesting, because there's a pressure between what President Donald Trump may want to do in terms of warming up the relationship with Vladimir Putin and the reality of what the Russians did on the streets of Salisbury in Britain.
Another place where this is getting interesting is with the role of Senator Rand Paul this week. He was part of a U.S. delegation to Moscow who delivered a letter from President Trump to Vladimir Putin. This trip came a few days after America's leading intelligence and security chiefs went public about Russia's continued efforts to interfere in America's electoral process. Here is Senator Paul speaking to reporters in Moscow.
We have agreed and we have invited members of the Foreign Relations Committee of Russia to come to the United States to meet with us in Washington. I think this is incredibly important, and those who believe in either country that we should not have diplomacy are greatly mistaken.
Part of Senator Rand Paul's remarks to reporters in Moscow this week. James Kitfield, what do we make of Senator Paul's presence in Russia? Is this just an attempt to play the Russians at their own game, to keep them guessing, or is this kind of deepening the confusion over what America's stance is? What is this?
I vote for deepening the confusion. There are two very separate camps in the American government, as has just been said, one of which led by President Trump, but also some of his chief interlocutors like Rand Paul and the seven Republicans who went to Moscow a couple of weeks ago, who basically are behind this idea of a sort of rapprochement with Russia, let's reset once again, and others who look at Russia's actions and go, until they change their behavior, we can't afford to sort of relax these sanctions and these various things, pressure points we're putting on Russia. So Rand Paul, it's not that surprising. He's a libertarian. He's very gets very nervous when we do sort of muscular sort of diplomacy. So it's not so surprising given his background. But this sort of confused message is certainly confounding the Russians. They are trying to figure out where this relationship is headed. And, you know, we put the sanctions on that Chairman Royce talked about, which only passed and was signed by President Trump because it was a veto-proof sanctions bill. Then we had the attack with the nerve gas agent. We expelled 60 Russians. Apparently, President Trump wasn't very clear about the number and was upset when he figured out that we expelled more than others. And now we have this law from 1991 that says they have no choice but to basically sanction Russia if it uses a biological chemical agent against a person. And these 90-day, you know, the next tranche of sanctions are really, really serious. So we're on two different tracks, and it's confusing to outside observers, and it's confounding to the Russians.
Simon?
I just want to make another point about Rand Paul. He was in Moscow the day that the State Department was announcing this finding on the use of nerve agents in the UK, announcing fresh sanctions would be kicking in, and he wasn't meeting any old Russians in Moscow. Among the Russians he met and invited to the United States is a man called Konstantin Kosachev. He's a member of the Federation Council, the equivalent of the Senate in Russia. He's the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he is sanctioned by the United States. This week, his response to what the State Department announced in terms of sanctions was to call the United States, and I quote, a police state dispensing justice in the worst traditions of lynching. And that's a man that Rand Paul has now invited to visit Washington, presumably at Donald Trump's behest.
Edward Van Court wrote on our Facebook page, it doesn't matter if it is Novichok, polonium, dioxin, or an ice axe. The Russians will murder casually and deny it casually. Is there any other kind of pushback that we see to the current stance on Russia or the confusion over America's Russia policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rand Paul visit just perfectly encapsulates the confusion, right? You know, like we just talked about, meeting with someone who is currently under sanction and inviting them to the White House, inviting them to the United States, is just beyond bizarre. And then there was this confusion over the letter. So he delivered a letter, Rand Paul, to Putin. And even the White House and Rand Paul couldn't get on the same message about what was even in the letter. So you just have, you know, the continuation of just ridiculous foreign policy dysfunction.
Let's keep going with sanctions and talk about the U.S. reimposing sanctions on Iran. Those sanctions had been lifted for a while as part of the Iran nuclear deal. And now that America has pulled out, the sanctions are back in. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman reported that these sanctions will make it harder for Iran to trade in gold and precious metals, graphite, aluminum, and steel. They're relatively small compared to the sanctions on Iran's oil sector and its shipping sector. Those go back into force on November 5th. Simon Marks, what do you think is important for us to pay attention to here as it relates to these new sanctions?
Well, I mean, there's no question that these sanctions are very bad news for anybody in the United States that enjoys Iranian caviar, Iranian carpets, or was perhaps, and I suspect there aren't many people out there, may have been thinking about purchasing an Iranian car. And there's also no question whatsoever that they're very bad news for Iranians that were thinking of putting their money and their wealth into American dollars, American gold, and other minerals that are now targeted as a result of all of this. But I think it's very important to bear in mind that this is not simply the United States sanctioning Iran. This is the Trump administration sanctioning Europe. The Trump administration behaves as though the Iran nuclear deal was some kind of bilateral arrangement between Washington, D.C. and Tehran. It's not. It's a multilateral agreement that the Europeans, the British, the German, the French, the European Union, the Russians and the Chinese still say they intend to honor. The Trump administration said this week through the president's tweet, anyone doing business with Iran will not be doing business with the United States. That's a pretty clear statement of intent. Well, who's doing business with Iran? China bought oil from Iran. India bought oil from Iran. Turkey buys oil from Iran. South Korea buys oil from Iran. Are those countries now going to be blocked from doing any business with the United States? And much more importantly, from a European perspective, what happens to all of those European companies that want to carry on doing business with Tehran that now run the risk of facing Justice Department and Treasury action if they go ahead and continue trading?
Let's expand on that line a little bit, James Kitfield. Here are a few moments from this week that also kind of illuminate how these two sides, America and Europe, are moving in opposite directions. First, there's Federica Mogherini, the European Union's foreign policy chief. She made it clear that European firms should just ignore President Trump and keep doing business with Iran.
I want to make this very clear because we're talking about trade and economic relations with Iran. Because this is part, integral part of the nuclear deal. The deal has two parts. Iran gives up their nuclear program and the international community opens up trade and economic relations with Iran.
It's Federica Mogherini, the EU's foreign policy chief. Now compare what she said to the response from Senator Lindsey Graham. Here he is speaking on Fox News.
World peace and the Ayatollah cannot fit in the same sentence. You got him on the ropes. To our European allies, it's disgraceful that you're picking this regime over the people. If President Trump will keep it up, European businesses are going to pick our economy over Iran. It's not if this regime falls, it's just a matter of when, if we keep the pressure on. And I think it's working.
So, James, you've got what Senator Graham says, you've got what Ms. Mogherini says. Who wins this? Where does this go? How does this resolve itself?
It's a really good question. And, you know, my prediction is probably not well. So here's why. From the very beginning, when we pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, there's two problems. We had isolated, the Obama administration was successful in isolating Iran and getting these sanctions adopted by everyone. I mean, basically Russia, China, the EU, everyone. So Iran was forced back to the negotiating table. By pulling out unilaterally, we have isolated ourselves, and we were forcing really our closest allies to abandon an agreement that they still think is very valid. So we are doing great damage to our transatlantic alliance, which is our top alliance, and we are also isolating ourselves. Now, I will say this: there are, you know, Iran is in a bad spot. These sanctions do hurt. There have been protests about economic situations inside Iran, and their currency has dropped. So it will create instability in Iran. But, you know, and color me, you know, skeptical that Iran's going to capitulate and come back to the negotiating table with Donald Trump and cut a much better deal, because the things they're asking Iran to do is kind of against their sort of resistance culture. So I don't think it's going to happen, but it is going to destabilize Iran for a while. And the hawks like Senator Graham love that. On the other hand, it's going to destabilize our own benchmark alliance with our European partners and isolate us from the rest of the world who wants to keep this deal going.
Jennifer, I wanted to get your take on this, especially in light of a tweet from Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif. He tweeted, quote, "Tantrums and capped tweets in all caps, won't change the fact that the world is sick and tired of U.S. unilateralism. Stopping U.S. trade and killing 100,000 U.S. jobs is fine with us, but the world won't follow impulsive tweeted diktats. Just ask EU, Russia, China, and dozens of our other trading partners," unquote.
Yeah, I think it's important not to really gloss over how influential and how much of an impact this is having inside Iran. So President Hassan Rouhani was summoned for the first time ever by Iranian members of parliament to come and essentially stand before them and explain what he's done wrong with the economy. You have to understand that Rouhani basically staked his political future on the JCPOA, on the Iran deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and basically said, look, guys, if we do this, I know you don't want to work with the Americans. I know we can't trust them. Yes, yes, death to America. But trust me, if we make this deal, sanctions are going to go away. It's going to boost our economy. It's going to be good for everyone. And he got everyone to go along with it. They signed the deal, and we promptly back out. So now he's standing there going, oops. And the economy is in free fall. There are protests in dozens of cities around Iran. And he is now basically facing the music from hardliners within Iran. So when they talk about, you know, instability, in some ways, you know, that one quote about, you know, the regime ending, there are some factions within the White House who would very much like to see regime change in Iran. Now, you want to talk about destabilization? Watch for regime change in Iran. That's going to be terrible for pretty much everyone.
Let's shift gears to another story that is affecting a foreign currency right now that several of you have asked us to discuss. RSB Sale wrote on our website, the1a.org, you should also discuss Turkey's declining lira. It has lost over 80% of its value in the past year versus the dollar and the euro. Another listener, Eric, wrote on our Facebook page, could you tell us more about the slide of Turkish currency and how American tariffs are contributing to the fate of a NATO ally? And Will tweeted, it's now quite evident Turkey is no longer a democracy, nor our ally. Suspending Turkey's membership in NATO should be considered. Our F-35 should be withheld. Now, behind all that, Simon, is the context of a tweet the president sent early this morning. The tweet reads, quote, I have just authorized a doubling of tariffs on steel and aluminum with respect to Turkey, as their currency, the Turkish lira, slides rapidly downward against our very strong dollar. Aluminum will now be 20% and steel 50%. Our relations with Turkey are not good at this time, unquote. So, Simon, the president said the Turkish lira is sliding downward, and lo and behold, it didn't just slide, it sank.
Yes, I mean, it sank, and then he put that tweet out, and then it sank
further.
It's lost
yeah.
20% of its value in the past week and 14% of its value in the last 24 hours. And that is all tied to great market skepticism about the capacity of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to deliver any kind of coordinated economic strategy that can pull Turkey out of the downward slide in which it finds itself, rooted in the fact that the market is very very skeptical about the outcome of the referendum a few weeks ago that dramatically expanded President Erdogan's powers. And this is Donald Trump just within the last few hours. And it's interesting that he tweeted on Turkey, but had nothing to say about those Russia sanctions that we were discussing earlier. This is Donald Trump kicking Turkey while it's down and saying, right, I'm going to ratchet up tariffs on both steel and aluminum, both of which are products that the Turks produce. Part of this is rooted in the administration's grave anxiety over the fate of a detained American pastor by the name of Andrew Brunson. He's accused by the Turks of having been involved in the 2016 coup attempt against President Erdogan. The Americans insist that he's an innocent Christian family man. He's been released from jail, but is now under house arrest in Turkey. But there's also another element to this, which is interesting. Donald Trump and Recep Tayyip Erdogan used to say nice things about each other, even while the bilateral relationship was deteriorating. That tweet may be an indication from Donald Trump that that personal relationship is now on the rocks, particularly after President Erdogan, within the last few hours, said that the Americans and other countries around the world may have their dollars to defend themselves economically, but we have our God. That is a claim that also spooked the financial markets.
Let's talk about another international relationship that seems to be on the rocks right now, the one between Canada and Saudi Arabia. A dispute over human rights has triggered a full-fledged diplomatic feud between these two countries. Now, this started a week ago, last Friday. Canada's foreign ministry tweeted, quote, all these stories, can I just tell how many stories? Did you ever think that we would be doing so many news stories saying, well, it all started with a tweet?
It's out of control.
Did anyone see this coming?
But in this case, that's the problem, right? I mean, Twitter, ladies and gentlemen, is not a great tool for diplomacy.
We're going to have to do an hour on just like the power of Twitter in the world, because this is, but it, anyway, let me read you the latest tweet.
Disruptive power.
God help us.
I never thought I'm going to have stories to tell my grandkids, I swear. Oh, we used to do diplomacy by Twitter, kids. Remember before we could just do it by, I don't know, talking to one another. So here's the latest tweet to start a news story. This one is from the Canadian Foreign Ministry. Quote, Canada is gravely concerned about additional arrests of civil society and women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia, including Samar Badawi. We urge the Saudi authorities to immediately release them and all other peaceful human rights activists. Unquote. The Saudi government responded with a number of retaliatory measures. And at a news conference on Wednesday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau defended his country's stance.
Canadians have always expected our government to speak strongly, firmly, clearly, and politely about the need to respect human rights at home and around the world. We will continue to do that. We will continue to stand up for Canadian values and indeed for universal values and human rights at any occasion. That's something that Canadians expect. It's something that I will always do.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau talking about how Canada, of course, politely, as Canadians are wont to do, chided Saudi Arabia over its human rights record. DP O'Connell tweeted, 1A teases a discussion about how Canada has offended the House of Saud. Let's talk about how the House of Saud took offense at true statements from the Canadians. A land that crucifies someone for theft doesn't have a leg to stand on when it comes to human rights. James, is that a fair assessment in terms of what's going on and the fallout? I mean, is Saudi Arabia overreacting to a real problem within its borders?
Well, it's got a terrible human rights record, and it has for a long time. But this is really about the new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who is a really transformational figure. He really holds all the reins of power. His father, the king, is ailing, and this young man wants to transform the society. And we're learning more and more about him as he takes the control of power. One of the things we've learned is he's got a very, very thin skin. Doesn't like criticism. One of these people that the Canadians were talking about, Raif Badawi, I think, has been sentenced 10 years for blogging. His sister, who is a women's rights advocate, just got arrested at the same time that he's trying to, you know, say that, you know, women can now drive and this is a we're reforming and becoming more progressive. So this is a very interesting figure, but also a very volatile figure. He, as defense minister, was key behind starting the war with Yemen. He has been key to trying to isolate Qatar. He's made a lot of very dramatic steps, and none of them have turned out really perfectly yet. And so I think this is really about everyone trying to get used to his leadership. And what the Canadians are finding out, yes, they've always criticized human rights violations wherever they see it. And so did we. Our State Department is vociferous about the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. But this guy has a very thin skin and lashed out.
Biberg Express tweeted, if the U.S. really cared about human rights, we would sanction Saudi Arabia, whom just crucified a guy yesterday and blew up a bus full of kids with our missiles. Jen, I feel like I need a little bit of clarity on what exactly is going on in Saudi Arabia. Like, I'm not following this granularly, but like,
sure,
crucifixions and missile attacks and so on. Like, what do we know about what's actually happening in Saudi Arabia?
First of all, just for clarification, this is something that the media tends to get wrong all the time by saying crucifixion. That means technically death by crucifixion, which is a very brutal, horrific way to die.
We're thinking like Jesus up on
precisely,
Friday. Yeah.
Precisely. It's not pleasant. It's horrific, right? The way they do this, they typically execute the prisoner first, and then they put the person up for public viewing, which is different. It's still, again, horrific.
Still not much fun, though.
Right, exactly. But just that's a weird little clarification, but it's just a different thing. But what you have to understand here is that, again, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he's known, he is kind of giving with one hand and taking with the other, right? So, you know, as James mentioned, the Samar Badawi was one of the human rights activists. She's an internationally renowned activist. She was one of the ones advocating for lifting the ban on women driving. So MBS does this, takes credit, gets all these glorious headlines in the West about how he's this, you know, reformer, and he's, you know, the new kind of liberal savior of the Middle East, which we tend to have a pretty poor track record on picking the reformer who's going to transform the Middle East. We thought Bashar al-Assad was going to do that a while back. That didn't work out so well for anyone. So, you know, he gets this credit, and then at the same time, he's cracking down hardcore on dissent. He's arresting the very people who are the ones advocating for these changes. So he's ruthlessly consolidating power. He, you know, the way the Saudi kind of regime used to operate is that you have several different branches of the Saudi royal family who all kind of compete for power. And they used to kind of essentially give, you know, one branch would get the military, the defense, you know, ministry. The other would get the interior ministry. So you get like the police and all of that. And then like a third branch would get the economy and energy. And so that way everyone kind of had to work together and build consensus, and no one kind of family line could do too much too soon.
Right.
MBS came in and took over all of those completely. He now controls essentially everything.
Doesn't feel, though, Simon, before we have to pause, like Canada had much to lose by criticizing Saudi Arabia. I mean, is the blowback that significant
for
Canada?
We should be clear why Canada got involved in all of this. It's because Raif Badawi's wife and three kids are Canadian citizens. I think there's a lesson in all of this, and it brings us back to where we started. Twitter, Chrystia Freeland, the foreign minister of Canada, probably should not have opined about this issue on Twitter. Diplomatic channels exist for diplomacy. Twitter is not a great channel for diplomacy, as the American State Department has also found out, with Mike Pompeo using the hashtag swagger to describe American foreign policy on a continuing basis.
Jennifer, we mentioned Yemen just a moment ago, and before we move on, we should bear in mind that about this war that's playing out there. An airstrike from the Saudi-led coalition hit a school bus in northern Yemen yesterday. Dozens of people were killed, many of whom are children. The UN considers this to be one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, if not the worst. I wonder where this puts us, whether this is just another tragedy in a years-running tragedy, whether we're reaching a point where maybe there's more international pressure for America to get tougher on Riyadh. Like, is this just another kind of, you know, a procedural note in this war, or is this a turning point?
It's absolutely horrific, and it's probably going to just get overlooked and be yesterday's news within hours. You have had the Saudis bombing, the Saudi-led coalition, bombing farms, bombing schools, bombing infrastructure, bridges. These are all war crimes, by the way. That's illegal under international law. And, you know, it's important to understand that the U.S. is involved in this. You know, we are involved in refueling Saudi airplanes, Saudi warplanes. in providing, selling them the munitions that they use to drop bombs on school buses. And one of my defense reporter, Alex Ward at Vox, yesterday spoke to a spokesperson for CENTCOM, Central Command, the Army Command, the military command that's in charge of the Middle East and all of this stuff. And there was an amazing on-the-record quote that basically said, we may never know if the munition that was used was sold by the U.S. because we don't have enough people on the ground. I mean, it was essentially a shruggy emoji from the Pentagon on the horrific massacre, again, illegal under international law. We're also supposed to be involved in helping with targeting. The entire idea of why we should continue to be involved with the Saudis in this is that, well, if we have, you know, U.S. military experts in the room, we can help make sure they don't target school buses or schools or open markets or weddings. But that's not happening. They're still doing it, and the U.S. does not care at all.
Tom is listening from Bath, Michigan. Tom writes, reporter Jane Ferguson is reporting on the terrible impact the fighting in Yemen is having on civilians. Her reports can be seen on the PBS NewsHour. The U.S. supplies the Saudi forces with bombs and missiles that are used on Yemeni cities, villages, and infrastructure. The U.S. cannot escape culpability for this humanitarian crisis. Speaking of wartime reports, I would also just mention the report that was aired last week on 60 Minutes about hospitals in Syria being bombed. Mm-hmm. Scott Pelley reported that. Very hard to watch, very necessary to watch if you have missed it. And of course, Jane Ferguson's reporting on the PBS NewsHour. James?
And it's a good point because, you know, getting in there, you see what goes on there and you see why we are not playing ball with Russia in Syria. Unfortunately, in Yemen, which is not as bad as Syria, but it's turning into a Syria. Millions don't have drinking water. They're being bombed. They can't. There's starvation. There is cholera. It is a horrible situation. And we have basically farmed it out to our allies, the Saudi Arabians, and they're mucking it up. And I think that if there's any turning point to come, it's when we start taking responsibility for finding a diplomatic solution. The Saudis aren't all to blame. The Iranian-backed Houthis are also not good actors either. But we have sort of washed our hands of this, and I think that's really indefensible.
Very briefly, Simon, before we move on.
There's a connective tissue between this and what we were talking about before. The U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia does not seem to be a relationship where the U.S. can constrain what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. Similarly, it does not appear to be a relationship where the U.S. can act as an honest broker trying to sort out the row between the Saudis and the Canadians. So much for what I was talking about before the break, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's reference to hashtag swagger when it comes to American foreign policy.
Let's make our way to Latin America, where a live televised speech by Venezuela's president on Saturday, this past Saturday, was cut short by an alleged assassination attempt. President Nicolas Maduro was addressing national troops in the capital city, Caracas, when a drone that carried an explosive detonated nearby. This happened less than 3 months after Maduro was elected for his second presidential term, an election that many considered fraudulent. First of all, Jen, do we know who's responsible for this attack, why it was carried out? Do we have any idea exactly what happened?
No. Nicolas Maduro, the president, has blamed everyone from the far right to Colombia's outgoing president, Juan Manuel Santos, to shadowy forces in Miami. He has long said that there are CIA assassination attempts against him, that they're trying to take him out. He's used this against opposition and said the opposition is trying to take him out and destabilize the government, use this as an excuse to crack down, not that he needs one because he just does it anyway. There are, you know, some people are wondering, did he orchestrate this himself to make him, you know, have yet another excuse to crack down. So it's completely unclear what happened besides the fact that I think it was actually two drones. One detonated and they claim that another one was shot down. But we know that drones were involved and we know that it happened in Venezuela. And beyond that, we don't really know anything more.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Jesus tweeted, it all looks like the Maduro's regime is using the strategy that Cubans used in the past to justify another round of persecution of political opponents. James Kitfield, I wonder if, I mean, some of this does sound exactly like the Castro playbook. He spent decades blaming the Cuban exile community in Miami mm-hmm. for any number of incursions or assassination attempts. He, of course, had a furious relationship with the group Brothers to the Rescue. This feels like a playbook of Latin American dictatorial, controversial, failing leaders who are starting to try to kind of deflect from what they're dealing with. Whether or not the assassination attempt was legit, it still sounds kind of like that playbook.
Right. So Maduro, was nursed at the breast of Chavez, who was basically in the arms of Castro. I mean, the Cuba's influence in what Venezuela has become is huge, and the fact that it is a failing state due to its failed economic socialist policies and the drop of oil prices around the world. He is lording over a failed state. I keep wondering, at some point, Venezuela, the inflation rate is so bad, people can't even, money's worthless. People are fleeing. Millions and millions of Venezuelans have fled to other places. He is sort of lording over a failed state. And this is kind of the playbook, stage an assassination and then crack down even more on the opposition, which he's done. He's already arrested some of the opposition lawmakers. No one knows yet whether this was staged or not. Maybe at some point someone's going to try to rebel against this. I keep thinking it's going to be the military finally going to have enough of this. But Venezuela has been on a downward spiral for a few years, and it keeps going down.
I have to say, I love that image. Nursed at the breast of Chavez and held in the arms of... Don't hold that image in your mind too much. You'll burn your retinas.
I shuddered a little. It's a little icky.
But I get it. It is accurate. I totally see the direct through line through the way all three of those regimes operated. I do want to talk about one other Latin America story, because we got a few other things we got to get through before our time is up, and that is in Argentina. This week, Argentina's Senate voted not to approve a measure that would have legalized abortion. Argentina is predominantly Roman Catholic. Pope Francis is Argentinian, but a loud grassroots abortion rights movement has mobilized to support this measure. Now, it failed, but not by much. The vote was pretty close in the Argentinian Senate. It was 38-31. It's been estimated that as many as 500,000 illegal abortions occur every year just in Argentina. I wonder what this tells us about a cultural shift in Argentina. Do we see things starting to change? Was this a flash in the pan? Is this the kind of thing that's happened before?
Well, I don't think it's a flash in the pan. I think it's an indication that change is coming. The people who favor this measure, which was going to permit abortion within the first 15 weeks of a pregnancy, may have lost this particular battle, but they must be heartily encouraged that ultimately they're going to win the war, partly because people who weren't on their side before, like the former Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, switched sides in this debate. She said because she had been so persuaded by the demonstrations that were taking place by Argentinian young women demanding this change. You're right, it was close. 38-4, 31 against, with two abstentions. The Roman Catholic Church, when it looked like a few weeks ago this might actually win, lobbied very, very heavily from the pulpits on Sundays to try and stop this measure from passing. But I suspect they've only stopped it from passing this time around.
Simon, let me stick with you for a second. You are just back from Africa, from South Africa. Yep. I wonder if we could talk briefly about neighboring Zimbabwe. Mm. We spoke earlier about the recent presidential election where Emmerson Mnangagwa was declared the winner of a highly contested election, an election that is still contested, frankly. The opposition leaders have trailed behind claims of fraudulence in the election. On Wednesday, an opposition leader named Tendi Biti was arrested at the Zimbabwean border after being rejected for asylum. There have been reports of abductions, harassment of opposition activists and the activists' families. What's going on in Zimbabwe? There was all this credit for the election being basically peaceful, and then all hell just broke loose thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, the outcome of this is still highly uncertain. It was a much closer election than Emmerson Mnangagwa and the ZANU-PF party that he leads, which is, of course, the party of Robert Mugabe. One could adopt the same kind of imagery that James adopted with regards to Nicolas Maduro when thinking about Emmerson Mnangagwa and Robert Mugabe. I mean, that's how close they were politically. Mnangagwa was Mugabe's prime henchman. This was a much closer election than they anticipated. Tendai Biti is the former Zimbabwean foreign minister. He now backs the Movement for Democratic Change, which is the opposition party whose candidate Nelson Chamisa almost won this election. He is now going on trial, accused of incitement for having claimed publicly that he believed Nelson Chamisa had won the election. He tried to flee to Zambia. The Zambians, in a very controversial move, didn't let him in and sent him back to Zimbabwe. He's now been released from jail, but his brother is claiming that he and other family members were taken into custody. The brother is claiming he's been tortured. The lawyer for Tendai Biti is also facing charges himself. The South Africans are trying to get involved. A very highly regarded South African advocate by the name of Dali Mpofu is now heading to Harare in a bid to represent Tendai Biti. But, you know, the ball is in Emmerson Mnangagwa's court. How brutal is this crackdown on the opposition going to be? And what kind of message does he want to send to the international community just weeks before he's due to come to New York to attend the UN General Assembly?
A few more stories we want to get to before our time is up. A couple cultural stories. And Jen, I wonder if you could start us with this story about Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary in Britain, somebody who has been floated as a possible prime ministerial candidate in the future, whether or not you believe that. He has been in trouble for a few remarks that he made. I want to play some of the public reaction to what he said, and I'll have you explain it. Here are some of the responses from Brits, from what I hear the British call the man on the Clapham omnibus.
What? No way.
Oh, my God.
Who do you think could have said something like that?
Somebody that didn't think before they spoke.
It's actually Boris Johnson, guys.
Really? Boris Johnson?
Isn't that really professional for him to say that?
Yeah, that's a terrible thing to say. But the guy's an idiot, so I wouldn't listen to anything he said.
A few views from the man on the Clapham omnibus or the man on the street. Jen, what did he say that had people so upset?
All right, so first of all, he didn't just say this offhand. He wrote it in his column in the newspaper, in his Sunday column. So he clearly thought it through. But what he said was he was reacting to in Denmark, the ban on the burqa just went into effect, banning Muslim women who wear the full face and body covering the burqa or the niqab, which covers the lower half of the face, from wearing that in public spaces. And Boris Johnson was reacting to that because apparently he didn't know how to keep his mouth shut, and basically said that while he doesn't support a ban on the burqa, he thinks they are ridiculous and they make women look like, quote, letterboxes and bank robbers. I'm not sure what bank robbers he's seen lately, but I'm pretty sure they don't wear burqas. It's a bit constricting. But it's not just Boris Johnson, right? It's part of this kind of broader culture war conversation that keeps coming up often when white conservative men of a certain class in Britain open their mouths. So after that, there was also, this has gotten less coverage, but there a conservative British columnist tweeted out that burqas, among the many reasons why they're bad, that they are bad because they are disrespectful to deaf people because they need to see people's facial expressions to communicate. Let me tell you.
But they don't restrict your hands. You could still sign.
Right. So the deaf community on Twitter was not having any of that. And they said, okay, excuse me. First of all, don't speak for us. And second, are you kidding me? Men with beards are also difficult to communicate with. We shouldn't ban beards in public spaces.
James, before we go, I should note that this issue of the burqa ban, regardless of what Boris Johnson said, this is kind of a real cultural touch point in Europe.
Sure. France has dealt with this in controversial debates. I was struck by how quaint this debate was in the UK. I mean, President Trump has called for banning all Muslims at one point from the United States. He's called Mexicans, you know, rapists and, you know, criminals and murderers, and some are good people. I mean, this comment has caused this massive debate in the United Kingdom. It just seemed quaint to me. We're way beyond this point in our own debate, and I kind of would like to get back to where they are.
I wonder how many tweets are going to be in the Friday News Roundup next week. How many news-making tweets? If they are, we would love to have you back to discuss them. James Kitfield, author of Twilight Warriors, The Soldier, Spies, and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. Jennifer Williams, the foreign editor of Vox. And Simon Marks, president and chief correspondent for Feature Story News. James, Jennifer, Simon, thanks for spending the hour with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.